Okay, so first, can you tell me your name and your title? And do I have permission to record, edit, and rebroadcast this?
My name is Teresa Bill, and I am the program coordinator for Bridge to Hope at the University of Hawaii. And yes, you have my permission to record and rebroadcast this interview.
Okay, and then I have a form that I'm going to send to you
okay.
to sign. So I'm going to start first by focusing on women. So I have 1908 to 1920 as the picture bride period. So why these dates, and who specifically are we talking about?
If you're talking about picture brides to Hawaii between 1908 and 1920, you're particularly talking about Japanese, Korean, and Okinawan women. And they are actually, when you do immigration history, all labeled as Japanese female immigrants because they're under the Empire of Japan. And you're also talking about specifically women because after the 1907 Gentlemen's Agreement, the restrictions on male immigration for laborers were much stricter, but women were able to emigrate as spouses or family members much easier.
And can you explain the dynamics of the Gentlemen's Agreement? I mean, some people have said that it's racism done cordially because of a growing power, political power of Japan. I mean, why is it called the Gentleman's Agreement?
The Gentleman's Agreement is indeed a nice label in terms of the diplomatic powers between the United States and Japan come to an agreement amongst themselves that the Japanese will limit their immigration of male laborers to the United States. And it's done it's a gentleman's agreement because it's very superficial in terms of specifics, and no one's talking about the real impetus behind the restriction on male immigration. And it is indeed a racist response on the part of the United States because of pressure from white workers believing that Japanese laborers and other Asians are impeding or restricting their access to employment. So it's really a political answer to a race-driven economic problem between laborers in the United States.
So what were the conditions like in Asia? What were the push factors for picture brides?
Okay, let's see. I'm not going to be very strong on this answer. 1908 to 1920, the factors that are really pushing immigration for sort of what are regular working people in Japan, Okinawa, and Korea sort of experiencing so that they would leave to either the United States or Hawaii. In Japan, there is a huge cultural change in terms of the placement for what can people who are not first sons have access to in terms of land. There's changes in the government and opportunities for people. And what you see a lot is everybody is always leaving their country because they need more access to land primarily, so that they, if they're farmers, that's their primary means of building their own family security. And the United States and Hawaii are places where people are seen as being able to acquire the resources that they can then purchase land. In Korea, especially for immigration to Hawaii, because immigration to Hawaii a lot of times is linked specifically to the recruiters who are recruiting people for the sugar plantations, there are people who are political dissidents who have difficulties or are repressed politically because of the Japanese government and their Korean nationalism. So that you see a wave and a push of people who are here in Hawaii because of political reasons. You also see people who, specifically from Korea, who are involved with the Methodist Church because they're interested in religious freedom and are practicing Christians. So that's sort of a cultural issue in addition to the sort of economic difficulties that people have. And in Okinawa, it's similar in terms of people desiring access to the resources so that they can buy land or acquire land for their family. Now, women aren't usually, if we're talking about picture brides, connected to sort of thinking about, oh, I want to acquire land for families. So everybody's stories are different, but a lot of times what you see are women who are particularly adventurous in terms of a willingness to leave their home community to agree to an arranged marriage to someone who's not only outside their family, but very, very far away. So some people have a sense of adventure, but then you also have people who, women who, just because of the composition of their family and their communities, are in arranged marriages that maybe they would prefer not to leave their families and live so far away, but they do. And usually people have some kind of, you know, arranged, people think about picture brides and think about it as a very sort of barbaric kind of practice. But it was actually in the early part of the 20th century, using photographs and steamship travel, a very modern interpretation of arranged marriages. It was just that people are then having to live far away from the community in which they would otherwise grow up, or in which there would be other kinds of supervision or social support as well.
One of the themes is disillusionment. So what did the women expect when they were deciding to become picture brides, and how did that truth bear out?
Immigration always has a multifaceted kind of interpretation. People's expectations are very, very high. There's always sort of the PR and the media expectations and the folklore. Everybody coming to the United States or Hawaii are expecting that they're going to make a lot of money. So in terms of people being disillusioned or not having the experience that they expected, I think women on the whole, one of the most easily documented disappointments they have is whether or not their husbands are the persons that they proclaim themselves to be to the matchmakers and to the families of the women. So that there's always folklore stories about men who utilize their better looking friends' photos, or younger men, or they send photos of themselves when the photo is actually, you know, 20 years old, so that by the time they have an arranged marriage and a bride, they're much older. I think women were expecting that if you went to Hawaii, you would work hard, but there would be financial gain. And that the largest disillusionment is for the same that all immigrants have in terms of the return, the expectation for how hard you have to work, and how hard it is to save money so that you can return to your homeland or you can send money to your family, that reality becomes very, very harsh, and that people expect that they hear the propaganda that recruits people to come to the United States or Hawaii says, oh, you know, they're paying, you know, 65 cents a day, and that translates into very high wages, but people don't then also take into account how much does it cost to live here and what else is happening and the difficulties of emigrating itself in terms of paying your passage, or if you're in a place and you're vulnerable and you're lonely, that you don't always save all your money, that you might spend some of it drinking or socializing or gambling or doing things like that. So I think a lot of the disappointments are that people have very high expectations about their immediate financial gain, and the harsh reality is that the working conditions are very poor, the wages are very small, and the community is very isolated. So people have financial and emotional difficulties.
I realize I didn't plug in the power.
Are you going to run out of your batteries? Is that kind of the, you know, you can ask me.
So when the picture bride women came over, what was their relationship to the plantation? Like, did they have to work? Did the plantations want them to come and work? Like, how, like, yeah. So how did that play out?
The position or the place of pitcher brides in the sort of larger plantation, sugar plantation community or hierarchy has a couple of different facets. One is that the planters did encourage their Japanese male laborers to bring brides and to establish families. There's always this discussion about how single male laborers are cheaper in terms of wages because they don't necessarily need a family wage, but they're also less stable in terms of employment. And so I think on the whole, planters were interested in facilitating women coming to the sugar plantations. But once they arrived, it isn't such that they have a requirement that they have to work. Young families want to, they're here in Hawaii because they want to earn money. So you're going to utilize everybody you can. If you have a nice, you know, young, strong, healthy woman who can work, then she's probably going to work. And what you see with sort of female employment on the plantations are women work in the fields and do fairly traditional employment until they have their first child. And then once you have a family and you have children, then some women continue to work in traditional sort of field work, but then other women find other ways to earn money. But women's employment certainly means that they are not the primary workforce for the plantation. So the planters are not the most particularly concerned about, you know, how do we keep female employees or what do we do? There's pressures from the Japanese community or the Okinawan and Korean community also. Any community that has women with children, that if women need to be in the workforce, then on some plantations there's daycare centers and there's some accommodation for mothers who are working. But on the whole, the plantation is not that interested or concerned about women as plantation workers. They are involved with women in terms of health care and child health care. So, in the 1920s, then a number of plantations target women and children's health as ways that they can interact with the families, so that there are clinics and public health nurses, and that is a avenue by which the plantation and the larger society has access to plantation families. What happens with sugar plantations in Hawaii, and I always want to encourage people to remember that every plantation is a little bit different. They have different managers, and the companies that own the plantations, different companies have different reputations for how much they're willing to spend on sort of employment resources. So some plantations like Eva Plantation on Oahu have reputations of being very socially responsible kinds of places, that if you're going to work someplace, you know, that's a good place to work, and that people who grew up on those plantations can articulate and remember the kinds of social paternalistic programs that that plantation had. Like Eva Plantation had an excellent health clinic. And then other plantations have reputations for being really like hell holes to work in, and that if you lived there, you didn't get hard, you know, they didn't invest a lot of money in their sort of human resources. And so they were, you know, they're not going to put money into a daycare center. They're not interested in why you're not coming to work. If they're not getting the productivity that they want from their workers, they'll either get new workers, fire these guys, or force them to work. So it really depends on the plantation and the plantation manager and who owns the plantation in terms of the kinds of social paternalistic programs. And that's the social paternalism is the nice face of the plantation. Some managers believe that, you know, a satisfied workforce will produce more for you than an unsatisfied and angry and a workforce that's always has problems. So some people agree with that philosophy, and then other people are, we're here to make money and we spend this much on wages and we expect this much in production. So they don't spend as much on the social reproduction of labor. So just like, I have to, like, my nose is itching. I was trying to think about what else was it that I was going to say. Oh, well. Oh, women in plantations. That's right. Do you want me to talk about their field work stuff?
Or? I'm going to get
to okay.
Now, can you describe a typical day for a woman on the plantation? And also, how did women's work generally compare with men's work?
Typical, sort of quote-unquote typical day for women sugar plantations in Hawaii starts very, very early in the morning, about 4 a.m. And women need to, of course, this is the early 20th century. If you're going to cook anything, you have to start your fire and boil your water and do all your cooking before anybody else is up. So 4 a.m., people, women are up, they're beginning to cook breakfast and lunch because you have to take lunch with you. So they are, oops, sorry about that. We can stop it and.
Okay, so
again,
we're talking about what is a typical day for a woman plantation worker and how does it compare to a man's?
Okay. A typical workday for a female plantation worker in the early 20th century starts very early in the morning, about 4 o'clock in the morning. With she's got to get up, make a fire, boil water, cook breakfast, cook lunch, and have everything ready to go for people because they are going to start their actual workday at 7 a.m. So usually at 6 o'clock, people are lining up if they have transportation to their outlying field if they have to work. Work days are 10 hours a day, so about 11:30 there's a short break for lunch, and then people work till 4:30 in the afternoon.
Can you say that again?
Yeah, I'm gonna stop just a second. I'm gonna look at my little thing. You know what? How I did it on the article about what the days start, because I was trying to think, okay, if they start at 7, what's 10 hours from 7 o'clock? 7 is 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. 5 hours. 5 o'clock. Oh, 4:30. Okay. Okay, we'll start over.
So why don't we just start from after, like, they've...
Okay, they've from. Gone to... They've gone to work into the fields. 11:30 is usually lunchtime. You get half an hour for lunch. And so you're eating your lunch that you made this morning. And then, because the workday is 10 hours long in field work, 4:30 in the afternoon or so is when people are finishing up and going home. Then, of course, for women... This is then the beginnings of their second job, right? Because they're going to go home and they're going to have to start their fires and cook dinner for their family. If their children are doing school, or if they've got any kind of, you know, if they're working in their garden, if they're doing any other kinds of activities for earning money, if they're going to be doing that after work. And they've got to, lights out whistles are usually at 8 o'clock in that night. So they've got between 4:30, 5 o'clock and 8 o'clock to do all their family work. Although a lot of times women are staying up beyond 8 o'clock, finishing whatever kind of sewing they need to do, any kind of creating of clothing, foodstuffs, items for their family. So, and spending time with their children. So, women's work days are long and continuous. It's very much like contemporary women in terms of having a paid job for wages and then going home and having a full-time job with family responsibilities in the daytime or after their day work. So,
and what was their actual labor like out in the field, and how does that compare with men?
Most women who are actually employed by the plantation in field work are, a lot of times they were working in what were called women's gangs, so they did particular kinds of work for the plantation. So often it was, depending on the season in which they're working, it's, you know, cutting new seedlings for the cane, pule-pule, or if they were hoeing and doing weeding, hohana. So they're doing some of the same backbreaking work that men are doing in the fields, but they also do some of the less physical work. But, you know, less physical is all relational, right? Because hoeing for 10 hours a day is still backbreaking labor. And cutting pieces of canes as young seedlings is still very difficult kinds of physical labor. They're not involved in as much sort of heavy lifting and carrying and things like that. They're also not involved in the higher paying, more skilled work either, so that they're not in the machine shops or the, you know, taking care of animals or doing things that would earn them more pay. So they have a fairly limited range of repetitive, highly physically demanding work.
And you sort of, what were women's relationships like on the plantation? Like, some of the things that came up for me is that there's ethnically separate camps. So mm-hmm. were these women work gangs mixed ethnically? Was there a kind of division of class? Because, you know, some of the stories that I've heard of were that the picture brides came, some came not like as labor, as workers, so then they were thrust into this sort of hard working conditions. So was there a class division? And then also, like, what were the support structures?
Okay. Maybe we'll do support structures last. Women who are employees of the plantation, that, you know, it's hard because the plantation community as a whole, some women are working in the fields as employees, right? They're field workers. And women's gangs, on the whole, tended to be women of different ethnic groups. So depending, it kind of depends on the demographics of the particular plantation. But Japanese women are the overwhelming majority, 80% of the female workforce on the plantations. So you get a lot of ethnic solidarity in terms of just they're the most numerous, even though in their work gang there might be women of other ethnic groups as well. And I think that you hear stories from women saying that they knew and met and worked with women of different ethnic groups in their gang. But the issues about women sort of really building solid relationships are, who do you entrust your children to? Who do you borrow money from? Who's your best friend? And I think that on the whole, the ethnic divisions between the living arrangements that people had, if they're living in ethnically segregated camps, as well as language difficulties, because immigrants are speaking their own language, and they have, you know, developed a workforce or a workplace language of Pidgin, but you're not going to develop a highly engaged and very emotionally deep relationship with someone that you can't speak with. So I think that women knew each other and could empathize and work together on a sort of social level, but that support systems were really between women of their own ethnic group. And some of that has to do more with just who do you feel comfortable with, who shares your cultural beliefs and your religious beliefs. And then the really important part about Picture Brides in both the continental U.S. and Hawaii is that they are in a place where they do not have a multi-generational female support structure. And they are really needing to rely on other young women who are also there. You know, some of them might be a little bit older. There's definitely women who are older, but there's the what somebody has once sort of explained or shared with me, sort of the blessings of having moved without your mother-in-law, but also with that comes you've also left your sisters. So unless you have other women. And so what happens is women create strong relationships between other women who are in similar situations. And a lot of times they're not necessarily their sisters or their sister-in-laws. Sometimes they are. But they're women who are in the same predicament that they are. They're women who are in a new land, have to raise families. These are also women who don't have a strong and long generational tie for childbearing in childbirth, so that midwives become really important for this particular cohort of young women, because we don't think about what do you do if you move someplace and your mother wasn't there to help you with your childbirth, right? Your sister, your older sister isn't there. You have to rely on other women in your community. And so women are building relationships, I think, more through who is it that came to Hawaii at the same time they did, who was experiencing things similarly. Now, there is definitely a difference in terms of whether or not you were an urban person in Japan or Okinawa or Korea, and then, or if you were a rural person. People like to think that farmers were more able to adapt to industrialized labor, but I don't necessarily think that's necessarily true. Sugar plantation production is industrialized agriculture. It is like industrial work. It is not like farming in that it is on a time schedule. It is a very rigid and works by the clock, and it doesn't matter what the weather's like. It doesn't matter what happened. You are at work from 7 a.m. till 4:30 p.m. So that rigidity and industrialized nature of work is something that is really overwhelming for everybody. Now, whether you had any expectation that you were going to perform physical labor, certainly women from rural communities are used to, you know, doing their fair share of hard manual labor. But urban women also found themselves sort of thrown into plantation labor and learned how to adapt. The other thing was that some people physically could not do plantation field work, so they would do other things to earn cash for their families. And so you see women involved in entrepreneurial activities, so that if they are doing the laundry or cooking meals or sewing clothes for especially the single male laborers of that plantation, that's how women who once they have children are able to.
Can you restate that?
Oh, sure. Women who are involved in other entrepreneurial activities like laundry, food production, you know, making meals, selling foodstuffs, sewing for the male laborers of their plantation communities. That's how women who earn money once they had children, if they had to leave the fields, or if you were incapable of working in the fields anyway. And what you see with the early Filipinas is that a lot of them, you don't see them in the employment records of the plantations because they're busy serving and working within their own community, sort of, but not in a paid labor force capacity. So they're still cooking and cleaning and sewing for men, but it's harder to sort of see that in the historical record.
You know, one thing that I missed in that time when in the question about disillusionment, and you mm-hmm. sort of addressed it now, but I'd like to kind sure. of have it answered directly, was so you brought up the photos, sometimes misleading photos, or that the immigration has a great, you know, PR. So how did the Picture Brides make that transition? How did they deal with this unexpected situation in all those different fronts that you brought up?
Okay. When Picture Brides are confronted with the reality of their immigration in terms of if their husband is not who he said he was, or the work and the life is much harder than they expected, I think you hear stories where it's not often said, but you can extrapolate from it, that women sort of subsumed a lot of their own emotional disappointment and pain. I mean, there's people are crying all night, but then realizing, what can you do? You have that emotional release about you. It's like you're stuck here. But when you look at what your options are, you have to pay for your passage back, or find a way to leave. Like, some people left their husbands, not lots of them, but that was an option for some of them for really drastic situations. But I think for the most part, the strength of women immigrants in terms of assessing their situation, realizing how limited their options were, and then deciding to focus on those things that they could actually impact. And one of them is, how are they going to make their life as best as they can? So they're going to work as hard as they can to save money, either for themselves and their family to go back home, or to send back to their family. Or once they've been here for a while, and this is the immigrant story for Hawaii's local people, and realizing you're not going back, right, that you have a family here, then spending your time and energy focusing on the betterment for your children. And then also commiserating with your friends, because you're all in the same boat, and the expectations that people had. And then over the years, I think a lot of older immigrants assess that the long-term gain that they have is a positive one. But we also have to remember that those are the people who decided to stay, and that the people who returned were either they returned because they had enough money to return, or they returned because they decided that Hawaii or the continental U.S. was not what they wanted to do, and that they were not going to achieve their dreams here.
Now, how did women integrate childbearing into their life and work? Mm-hmm. You touched on this, but this is a more direct question. And then also, what role did men play with that?
With childbearing? Okay. It's difficult because from what I've seen in historical employment records, there are some women who are always employed on the plantations, even throughout their childbearing years and their raising children. And for those who have access to someone who can watch their children while they're in the plantation fields, or they have a baby home or a child center available, they can combine field work and their child raising. But for many women, once they have children, there's this transitional time, because when you have really young children, you would stay out of the plantation fields and try and earn money by doing laundry or other sort of money-earning activities. And then once your children are old enough to watch the other children again, you can return home or return back to the fields for paid employment. So I think women are always a very important economic contributor to their family, in that their family requires that they earn some kind of money. So whether it's wages in the field, or they're doing laundry and meal preparation or sewing or any other kind of little thing that they can do to earn more money, you know, growing vegetables and selling those. they'll do that. And what women have to do is, it depends on their own personal resource set of who can help them with child rearing. I have not heard a lot of stories that indicate there was a large amount of father involvement in child rearing. So I think for the most part, in the early 20th century, very few cultures in the world have an expectation that fathers are going to provide direct child rearing. So it really falls on women. And then what happens a lot of times are families that might be in debt, especially, or families that, if the mother is widowed, you see that the eldest daughters become the somebody that the mothers really lean on heavily and really rely on, either for them to care for their younger children or their siblings, so that their mother can go to paid employment, or that they themselves leave school and go into paid employment. So it's really mothers and eldest and elder daughters who really form this real economic foundation for both the family as a complete economic unit, because men's wages are so small, but also the eldest daughters keep the families running if the mother is involved in other activities.
Okay, another thing that I'm going to try to address is the triple oppression that women on the plantations faced of being women, being not white, mm-hmm. and being the working class folks. So can you describe these different oppressions on the plantation and how the women coped? I guess it's kind of similar to the disillusionment one, but from a different angle.
Yeah, this one's harder. Yeah, you can answer this one. You can do all kinds of things. Okay. So Asian women on the plantations have a triple burden of oppression in terms of, as women in the plantation communities, they are not equally valued as workers. They do not have equal voice or position in their families. And as Asian women in the plantation, certainly being non-white means that the racial hierarchy you're lower. But then even within Asian communities, there's different hierarchies for different ethnic groups. And so, and then being the working class and the producing class of Hawaii puts another burden on women in terms of being compensated in such a small way for such an enormous amount of work. And this really becomes a quite heavy load for women. And I think women of color throughout history find that these are similar, they're similarly situated. But as immigrants, you have less access to power, you have less access to English language, you have less access to other earning opportunities. And on the plantations, there really is a sole source of power, and that is the plantation and the plantation manager. It is a very constricting and restrictive community. And if you were brought to Hawaii on a contract, you were expected to fulfill that contract. And of course, when you're earning very small wages, a lot of families were in debt to the plantations. So it was not a matter of just being able to pick up and leave and go start anew someplace else. How women really address these or engage or keep themselves going despite these oppressions and the difficulties, I think in terms of the gender oppression, women really had strong communities with their peers, and that's always been a strong resource for women, that despite how lonely or isolated they might feel from their family of origin, that they end up forming very strong friendships with particular women. In terms of the ethnic and racial oppression, I think women are involved politically in some labor organizing and some political activities, depending upon their particular personal interest. So you see some, especially among the Korean community, women who are very much involved in Korean nationalist activities. And also, people come with a strong belief of who they are as their own. Like, nobody in Japan thinks, oh, I'm Japanese, and this means I'm going to be, you know, different than other people when I get to Hawaii. That people are who they are, but when they come to a new place and they find that they're treated differently because of their ethnic background, then they have to begin to think about the power structures that reinforce this and how can they acquire or wrestle some power for their own community. I think that's how women a lot of times put their energy into their child rearing and education of their children, feeling that that will help the larger community in addition to the local community politics. People also, immigrants, when they leave their home countries, don't just abandon their politics and things from their home country either. A lot of people are involved in the political discussions and political turmoil of their home countries. In terms of the class issues in Hawaii, I think people came to Hawaii, they understood that they were going to be laborers, but might not necessarily have understood that this meant that they were going to be at the bottom of the hierarchy. And I think that that's where you see more of the labor organizing and political organizing in terms of feeling that we might be laborers, but we have a certain level of human dignity and we require, you know, a certain level of payment, and we have to be able to sustain ourselves and sort of the Marxist reproduction of the workforce, that if you don't pay us enough that we can build our families and build a community, then we have to engage in organized behavior and organized resistance. And I think that's where you get the labor organizing.
Great. So now, how did the influx of women to Hawaii, particularly with the picture brides, how did that change or develop plantation culture?
So the influx of picture brides really begins to change the plantation community from a overwhelmingly single male laborer community and culture to one that's more focused on families, especially within the Japanese American community. There have always been women and there's always been families, and different ethnic groups on the plantations have different demographics in terms of, you know, the Puerto Ricans or the Portuguese have really strong family development, but they also have a lot of single male laborers. But with the direct sort of large influx of picture brides, you see this change into more of a focus on meeting the needs of families and the needs of laborers who are heads of households. So part of it is that you end up with demands for better housing. You end up with demands for more pay because workers who have families need to earn more. They might be more stable employees and come to work more often than single men, but they also have more obligations. You also see some development of social organizations that are not just for single men. But you also see this bifurcation, so that whereas you have to remember, if we're talking about single male laborers, you know, we're talking about 17, 18, 19-year-old, 20-year-old males, and they're very interested in, you know, alcohol, gambling, prostitution and organized sports. And those are activities that are in direct opposition to what are established as family concerns, right? That if you have a family community-based concern, then you don't, you know, you're interested in limiting access to all of those things. And you're also concerned about your children's access to young men. And you're concerned about young girls' access to a community that has a high density of single males. So women, picture brides really are the beginning of the turn towards a more family-oriented and community-based that's more than just single men, so that you can begin to see, you know, there's more religious organizations, there's schools, there's social, there's always social fraternal organizations, but when they're meeting the concerns of single men, they do different things than when they're meeting the concerns of families. And with families, you also see that people begin to have an orientation towards the future that includes their children, and they think about whether or not they're going to be staying where they're living and investing in making that particular place and that particular place better as a community, or are they thinking that they're just going to be working here for a little while and then they're going to be moving on? So you have people investing more of themselves politically and emotionally in a community that includes what they see now are their children.
So that kind of brings me to asking you about women's contributions to labor resistance. And some of that was like who contributed and how, and primarily in my labor resistance section, I'm looking at individual acts, and then 1909, probably 1920, and then 1946. So, like, were they contributing as workers in the fields, or were they contributing as family members of workers in the fields, or was there a transition in that? All of that.
Yeah. So women's participation in organized labor resistance or organized labor takes a couple of different means. Women in 1909, the largest sort of labor strikes and labor events are 1909 and 1920, when there are island-wide strikes on the plantations. And women are definitely part of the field labor force at that time. And they are very much a part of withholding their labor during these strikes. Women are not particularly visible in terms of the leadership of the strikes, but the 1920 strike does include demands for maternity leave and some other issues that are particularly important to women. Although they were also important to men in terms of maternity leave and acknowledging that there are female waged workers in the fields who need a break and then the ability to come back to their employment after they have their children. Women are also, of course, vital in the traditional sense of offering support service during a strike, right? So that if people are kicked out of their plantation housing like they were in the 1920 strike, then who is, you know, feeding the strikers, who's taking care of families, who's maintaining and pulling together the sort of tent cities where people are congregating after they've been expelled from their housing. So women are really needing to be, you have to visualize them sort of everywhere, because the historical record doesn't give us a clear picture of where they are. We have to assume that they are involved in everything, but because of their family responsibilities, they are not going to be at the forefront of a lot of public events. They're not the leadership, they're not the vocal members, but they are able to articulate that they have concerns like maternity leave for the 1920 strike. Now, the 1909 strike, there are many fewer women who are in the field labor at that point. Their immigration comes after that strike. But the women who are involved are solid in their walking away and striking the plantations. So the 1909 strike is particularly of Japanese workers. So what the planters then believe is that they have to expand their labor pool beyond the Japanese because they're constituting 75% of the labor force. And that includes women. So in terms of the after the 1920s, we see you know, women are having children, and we see fewer women as field laborers. But they are working then in some of the second generation women are working in the offices. And in the 1946 strike, we see women not so much as field laborers, but more as community support and giving emotional as well as physical sustenance to the strikers. So it's actually, there's a need to be more imaginative about where we see women in individual resistance and in collective resistance, except to know that they are solidly supporting those strikes and those labor events, because there's no way that you can have a 100% or nearly 100% walkout without the support of your family and women in the community. So that's a very key component that they play.
Okay, so I'm going to transition a little bit more towards labor, I think. I only have three more questions.
Okay. Is it the kind of, I mean, am I giving you what you want?
Oh, yeah, totally.
Okay, all right.
So this question is about cheap labor. Why were men specifically recruited? And in terms of recruitment, how are women viewed? And then talk about, because Franklin Otto said that Japan, the Japanese government made a point that one in five immigrants would be women.
Mm-hmm.
So, again, could you talk about why men were specifically recruited and how women were viewed? And then why Japan had this one in five rule?
Oh, I want to know why they had the one in five rule. Actually, my foot's falling asleep. I have to, like, move. Let me think about this for a minute. So when did Franklin say that one in five? That sounds right, but I was like, I don't know about the particular, like, edict that they have. So, and that was pre-1908, or?
It was during the contract phase, I think.
The contract, because the contract phase is like the 1870s through the turn of the century. Okay.
If you're not familiar with it, that's okay. You don't have to address that one.
Well, I'll have an opinion about why it might be, but. I was just thinking, okay. Okay, so why were male laborers recruited to work on the plantations?
Like, why specifically male?
Why specifically male? Because it's hard work. Okay, so male. So, okay, just a second, I have to think. So we're transitioning to just labor questions more than about sort of female workers. Okay, so why are... So males are targeted primarily for labor recruitment because they are capable of working very hard. Plantation labor is physically exhausting. It is physically exhausting for men as well as women, but certainly men are associated with much more physical labor. And also, you do not have to have community oversight of single males also, and that communities are much less likely to send young women to be recruited for work unless there is a means by which you can guarantee their sort of physical and moral and social well-being. So men would be recruited primarily because they are able to leave a community and go someplace that might not be well monitored. So in terms of having a requirement that there a certain percentage, like 20% or 1 in 5 workers be female, has to do with a couple of different things. One is the same desire to have a community that is not entirely single males, young single men, and that there is a desire to have women as the bearers of family and social and community mores. So that, and also because the Japanese government was very aware of sort of the anti-Asian sentiment of the United States against Chinese laborers. And Chinese laborers were not particularly, like, there was no attempt to require women immigrants. So the Japanese government is interested in sort of like, well, we're have families and women and not just sort of single male laborers as a competitive workforce. And that's more, I think, diplomatic and trying to address what they knew that there was anti-Asian and anti-Chinese sentiment when the Japanese are being recruited. But whether or not that, you know, the United States is not good about differentiating between Asian populations. While Japan would say, well, we're not China, but we're still going to try and maintain a more well-rounded community and include women as immigrants.
Okay. So, there's this popular myth, and you talked about the PR of getting immigrants to come mm-hmm. and do this hard labor. And the myth was that if you worked hard, you could make a lot of money to send home. And my friend was saying, wasn't that always unrealistic? And weren't they intentionally misled or misinformed in order to secure this cheap labor force? Mm-hmm. So could you talk about that and in terms of laborers and recruitment in general mm-hmm. and sort of how that fits into capitalism or this expansion of the U.S. into Hawaii?
The discussion about the expectations that immigrants have because of the recruitment that's made. The belief for that recruiters will pitch to all immigrants that, you know, the United States or America is the place paved with gold and you can make your fortune is not an accurate, it was never an accurate depiction of what people actually had to do. And you're never really sure, you know, whether people, like, in their heart of hearts, they knew nothing could really be that easy, but they didn't necessarily know how hard it would be. Immigration requires that people leave a secure, known community for an unknown place and unknown work. So recruiters have to, if they gave people the reality of how it was, that you're going to work 10 hours a day, 6 days a week, and you're going to be so tired from the physical labor that you won't be able to get up the next morning, but we're going to kick you out of bed and whip you until you get there, people would not necessarily, you know, no one would come if they knew that that was the reality. I think a regimented and underpaid workforce is how the sugar plantations make their profit. They could theoretically afford to pay more. They could have shorter work hours. They could, but the work is still going to be physically backbreaking. Industrialized labor, the United States grows because of the blood and the sweat and the tears of all its industrial workers, immigrant, native, but especially immigrant workers who are paid the smallest amount of wages possible. And that workers really have no way until they've engaged with this industrialized machine to calculate or understand what they're expected to give in return for what they're going to get. Immigrants have always been the most vulnerable and the least paid of workers in the United States and Hawaii. And it is a, there's a link between our own sort of national mythology that yes, everybody, you know, works their guts out, but then it's better for their children in the next generation. And that's our mythology because people who stayed here are the ones who said, okay, this was worth it. We don't, in our mythology, take into account the people who said, you know, forget this. I can't do this anymore. We forget about the people who are broken physically and emotionally and who their children are left to themselves or else they don't have children. And young single men, this male labor force that gives their physical strength and energy to this industrialized machine, they have to be replaced. They can only work for so long, and that's part of this the recruitment and the mythology is you have to be continually recruiting because the plantation machine and as well as the industries on the mainland are just chewing young workers up. That's how industrialization occurs, and that's how quote-unquote progress and growth are made. And I don't think that people can ever have a clear idea of what it is that's required of them when they're emigrating. If you told them what it was really going to be like, no one would come. I don't know, what else did you want on that?
That's good. So my last question is, you know, this documentary, we're focusing on Asian immigration to America, mm-hmm. but I don't want to leave out the Native Hawaiian population. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And so we talk about the sugar plantations as a vehicle that it makes Hawaii become part of the U.S., mm-hmm, mm-hmm. right? But I'd like to have you talk about plantation labor history, plantation history, and its relationship to the U.S. colonization of Hawaii. You know, so like with the growth of the sugar plantation, that leads to the, you know, the overthrow of Hawaii, mm-hmm, right, and the mm-hmm. annexation and all of that. So,
oh, you want me to pull all that stuff together?
Yeah, and at the same time, I'll just throw this out there and see if it kind of ties into anything that you might say. Like, people, you know, say that, like, well, the Civil War was 1868 or so. So in this same time period, we're looking at, like, forced slavery of Africans. And then some people have talked about the West Coast and Asians being, like, that almost comparison of that very low paid labor on the West Coast for very mm-hmm, harsh mm-hmm. conditions. So how is this reflected in the plantation labor story and the picture bride story?
Slavery.
Not necessarily slavery, but like U.S. colonization of Hawaii.
Okay, so the first question is how sort of plantation development links with territory and the acquisition of Hawaii, okay, and the overthrow. I'm gonna have to think about this in terms of, okay. You know, I'm always really bad because I don't ever remember the diplomatic
Okay, the reciprocity agreement, and then that's the big one. And then when does Pearl Harbor get, like, that part of reciprocity? And reciprocity...
The development of sugar plantations in Hawaii and its relationship to the colonization of Hawaii and its acquisition or over the overthrow of the Kingdom of Hawaii. Sugar is intimately involved in all of this development. When the sugar planters and the sugar factors, the people who own plantations, are all owned by sort of what we now call offshore, you know, corporations. And they're all owned and run by Americans. With the development of sugar and the industrialization of sugar, Hawaii needs to be able to sell their products. And they develop the reciprocity agreement with the United States between the Kingdom of Hawaii and the United States, that the United States will accept Hawaii's sugar without placing an importation fee, and in exchange for the Pearl Harbor Delta. So it is really the militarization of Hawaii, and the United States is intimately interested in Hawaii because of Pearl Harbor. And what happens are the sugar planters are kind of, you know, they're Americans who are living in Hawaii. And the Kingdom of Hawaii, you know, does not require that they be citizens. So the sugar planters are very interested financially in what the United States and the Kingdom of Hawaii are doing. But the United States, you know, until Pearl Harbor becomes sort of part of the negotiations and becomes something that the U.S. can acquire, then, you know, the United States doesn't care about Hawaii sugar. But with the ability to access Pearl Harbor and then be able to export sugar to the United States tariff-free, then there's a lot of infrastructure development and money flowing into Hawaii from through sugar, so that the development of the sugar industry correlates to the rise in power of the American white elite in Hawaii, which then challenge and are part of the overthrow of the Hawaiian kingdom, so that Hawaii's loss, the Kingdom of Hawaii's loss to the United States, is a military overthrow, but sugar is intimately involved in pressing for Hawaii's giving of the Pearl Harbor Delta to the United States. In terms of, okay, I'm gonna stop. What were the other questions?
So I guess my other question is about colonization and thinking about colonization and how building a colony requires low paid labor.
Mm-hmm.
And the native population was dying off,
mm-hmm.
or, you know, could choose not to work. So in terms of this U.S. colony in Hawaii, how does the Picture Bride story fit into that? And how do the plantation laborer story fit into that?
So the 20th century, once Hawaii is a territory and a colony.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
I mean, even that process of building U.S. infrastructure in Hawaii, like, so even, you know, through the late 1898, I guess.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Okay, I have to think about this a little bit more. How are you doing for time? Oh, yes.
Lisa, on your digital? 6 minutes. So
okay, well, I shouldn't have, I don't think I have 6 minutes to say about that.
Okay.
let me think about how I want to talk about colonies. Okay. The relationship between the sugar industry and the United States and its development in terms of Hawaii as a colony. Hawaii is a territory of the United States once it is overthrown and taken. But Hawaii really works as a colonial economy in terms of the workforce is low waged, the workforce is very vulnerable to exploitation and expulsion, right? That if you're an immigrant and Hawaii and the United States decides no more Japanese immigrants, then there aren't going to be any. It also has, as a colonial economy, the top tier, sort of the people who are implementing economic and political decisions are those white Americans who also control financially the plantations. So that what colonies are about exporting and exploiting natural resources for the benefit of the host country. So that Hawaii is busy growing sugar and exporting it, and the money that is made from this goes to corporations that are American and that benefit a very small percentage of the population. And there's a small educated and white colonial administrative sort of level. Native Hawaiians are also still involved in terms of the local legislature, but they've been basically disenfranchised by the United States taking Hawaii as a territory. And the United States is most interested in Hawaii as a resource for its military, so that it is then a refueling station for Pacific exploration as well as Pacific wars. So everything that Hawaii does industrially becomes an important resource or is directly tied to what does the United States need, either militarily or economically. And if the United States doesn't need sugar from Hawaii, then they're not really that interested in it. But once it becomes a territory, there's a lot more obligation to meet the needs of Hawaii's sugar industry. Now, in terms of labor, Asian immigration, and women immigrants, for a colonial economy, you have to have a workforce that is replaceable and is under duress in terms of that there's a lot of ability to say no more immigration from this country, or we're going to return you. And we see in Hawaii in the 1930s with the economic depression that Filipino immigrants are encouraged, quote unquote, to return to the Philippines. And because the United States is also colonized the Philippines, there's a much more fluid migration between the Philippines and the United States. But the United States also has a lot more power and control over that immigration and those immigrants. I don't have a good wrap up for that. 3, 2, 1, home country.
Can you say it a little bit faster?
Home country.